So dear friends, the topic of this evening's talk is Gurus and Chelas. Now, in our everyday life, since our childhood, we have come across multitude of gurus. Since birth, it is said that parents are our first gurus. And then when one proceeds towards his childhood, his teachers are perceived as gurus. Then in his college, his professors are perceived as the gurus. And then again, when he enters his professional life, again his seniors and employers, who are much more experienced in the particular field of endeavor, they are perceived to be gurus. So the concept of guru is not new to us. At every stage in life, most of us have come across multitudes of gurus. And then, of course, there are other kind of gurus when we try to pursue some extracurricular activities. For example, we may take up singing, we may take up dancing, fine arts, we may take up gardening. The masters in their own particular sphere of experience, they are perceived as gurus by us. And not to mention, there are multitudes of yoga teachers who teach about the yogic practices. They are revered as gurus and they are celebrated. Then there are, for every step we take in life, we look into some calendars. And there are authors of those calendars, panchangas, they are called as gurus. We consult astrologers, palm readers. If there is something wrong with the way in which the life is going on, then we consult the Vastu Shastra experts to make adequate modifications in the building. They are called as gurus. And then any auspicious occasion, for example, it may be a child naming ceremony, a marriage, or even if it is a death, the scholars are invited, the Vedic scholars are invited, and then libations are poured. Lot of rituals are taking place, and they're all revered as gurus. And then there is the whole group, bunch of institutions, the temples, the mosques, the churches, the religious institutions, they are gurus. Be it the maulvis, be it the priests, be it the temple priests, all of them are consulted as gurus. And then of late, there are lifestyle teachers who really guide the people as to how to overcome the difficulties in life. Then there are psychologists who counsel people as to how to, you know, inculcate certain practices so that you fit yourself to be a part of the society. Then there are corporate leadership teachers who build the leadership abilities in the students and their employees. And there is an ocean of self-help books. And there are, of course, in every corner, there are spiritual teachers. And they have their own channels. There are tens of channels which are dedicated for building leadership. They are dedicated to inspire people into action, to become better citizens, and to become better persons in the society. And then finally, there are gurus who apparently summon the spirits by performing some rituals, and then they foretell the future of a person, and then they also aid the student apparently in recalling their previous lives. All of them are called as gurus. So in fact, if we look at it, gurus are omnipresent in our day-to-day life. Therefore, one may say that we are surrounded by gurus. Not to mention, in these days, internet itself is a guru. There is no need of any personal guru. And there are multitudes of experts answering all sorts of questions to help the people. So when this is the state of affairs, now what does theosophy have to say about gurus? That is the topic which you are going to consider further. what does a guru mean in the theosophical parlance? For that, we will briefly consider the very definition of a guru, which is given in the Theosophical Glossary. Gurus. Guru is a Sanskrit word, which means a spiritual teacher, a master in metaphysical and ethical doctrines, used also for a teacher of any science. All the examples considered till now, there are gurus all around us. They are more or less classified under a teacher of a science, of a particular knowledge which he has acquired over many years, slowly, over decades together of practice and experience and study. One person would have acquired a kind of an expertise in a particular topic of a particular science. Those are the teachers which we know of, which we come across in everyday life. But there are other kinds of teachers who are masters in metaphysical and ethical doctrines. Masters who are masters in ethical doctrines are a class of gurus which are rare to come across. For example, the best example which will come to us when we study the history, he was one of the masters of ethical doctrines who applied it practically in his life. We can consider the example of Mahatma Gandhi, who, when one studies his works, we will know that how over a period of sustained effort of 20, 25, 30 years, he slowly acquired the doctrines through study and then he applied, which he has captured in his work, The Story of My Experiments with Truth. He is one of the masters of ethical doctrines, and very aptly he is called as a Mahatma and revered by all of us. But when we consider the gurus for masters in metaphysical doctrines, now here is where a problem starts, because there are many self-appointed gurus of metaphysical doctrines, this which will border on supernatural phenomena, performance of supernatural phenomena, which will border on hypnotizing a subject, which will border on mesmerism, which will border on making some rituals so that a foreign entity comes and sits, acquires the body of a subject, and then manipulates the thoughts, feelings, and actions of a subject. Now, here is where there are many self-appointed gurus who consider themselves master in metaphysical doctrines, and one must really be wary of such gurus, because theosophical doctrines very clearly state that this following a guru who is into practices of metaphysical doctrines, practicing the metaphysical doctrines like hypnotism, mesmerism, leads at best, it leads to insanity, and at worst, it will lead to total moral degradation of the subject. So one must be wary of such gurus who practice metaphysical doctrines. But finally, the ultimate kind of guru we will find in the definition of a guru as a spiritual teacher. Now, who is a spiritual teacher? That is the question which we are going to consider. And if we can recall the verse considered from the Dhammapada, page number 44. Now, he who takes refuge in enlightened one, in the law, in the order, perceives clearly the four noble truths, suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the Noble Eightfold Path, treading which all suffering is transcended. Now, a guru is the enlightened one who is a part of the law and also the part of the order, who clearly perceives these truths. And he has enduring patience . But as Buddha says, trackless indeed is he, and none of this world can touch that victory. He is a seer of limitless range. And even the devas and the gods aspire to emulate the enlightened wise, who are great contemplators, who are the peaceful ones, who are steadfast and tranquil. Such a person, rather an entity, is called as a guru in theosophical parlance. Now, where can we find such a guru? Where can we find? Is it a stroke of luck that we find such a person? Or is guru really a person whom we come across in our life? Or is guru an idea which we are going to try and develop over a period of time? So who is a guru? What is a guru? What is the idea of a guru? Are we going to meet such a guru in person? Are they really existing? These are all the pressing questions which comes into our mind. Do gurus really appear in nature by themselves, or the gurus are someone who have evolved through their personal effort or merit? These are all the questions which come in. Therefore, we can consider one short passage from the magnum opus, Secret Doctrine, which speaks about, which briefly captures the scheme of the whole universe, as well as the purpose for which a man is born in the universe. So this is a very fundamental doctrine of theosophy, which says that there is a fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, and the universal oversoul is an aspect of the unknown root. And there is an obligatory pilgrimage for every soul, which is a spark of the unknown. And through cycle of incarnation or necessity, and in accordance with cyclic and karmic law, there is evolution that happens. It further says that no purely spiritual buddhi can have an independent existence before the spark which issued from the pure essence of the universal sixth principle, or the oversoul, has passed through every elemental form of the phenomenal world of the manvantara and acquired individuality, first by natural impulse, and then by self-induced and self-devised efforts, checked by its karma, thus ascending through all degrees of intelligence, from the lowest to the highest manas, from mineral and plant, up to the holiest archangel, Dhyani Buddha. This pivotal doctrine of esoteric philosophy admits no privileges or special gifts in man, save those won by his own ego, through personal effort and merit, throughout a long series of metempsychosis and reincarnations. This fundamental postulate of theosophy admits of no special privileges or gifts in man, save for those won by the ego through personal effort and merit. Now, through personal effort and merit, checked by karma, when a person tries to evolve, he will become a guru. So the gurus are not someone who appear by themselves in the universe. Gurus are those persons who were once men like us, and through their personal effort and merit have acquired the knowledge and wisdom and discrimination and have reached the stage of a guru. That is the theosophical doctrine of gurus. and they don't appear by themselves. Men like us have become gurus. That is the fundamental doctrine of theosophy. And that is what, that is also one of the goals towards which the students of theosophy aspire to. Through their personal effort and merit, through a long series of metempsychosis and reincarnations, one acquires such a knowledge and such a wisdom that he will become a part of the nature, he will become a part of the law, and he works with the law. Such a person is a guru. And once a person becomes the guru, is that the end? Person becomes a guru, a man like us, the students of theosophy, if he becomes a guru, is that the end? Is that the scheme of the universe? Can that be a scheme of the universe? The theosophical literature clearly answers that is not the case. Once a person becomes a guru, he becomes a part of the law, and it becomes his duty to come back and raise all of us, be it the elemental, mineral, plant, animal, humans. It becomes his duty to raise all of us to the status of a guru. That becomes his duty under the law. Therefore, gurus are all around us. Guru does not necessarily mean a physical body. A guru is a soul who, having attained to such a stage of evolution that he becomes one with the law, and whenever the law permits, for example, there is a lot of confusion in the society, lot of superstition, and then there may be rulers who are very tyrannical, imposing laws, taking away whatever the people grow. There may be a lot of crime in the society. And then when the people like us, when we summon a savior, a guru, and we start questioning as to why is this happening to us? Why is the king treating us like this? Those are some of the circumstances in which the people themselves summon such a high exalted soul, takes up a body. Basically, the gurus make their own body and then are born among the society so that they promulgate the old truths. They don't promulgate something which is new. They don't invent anything. They repromulgate the same old truths which have been present always. The same eternal truths are repromulgated in the local language of the people. So when we really say that we came in touch with the guru, it is not so much so that it is the physical body that one must think about when we see a guru. It is the soul which has built that body and come in amongst us to repromulgate the same old eternal truths. So we really may not perceive a guru because a guru is not a physical body. But at the same time, we can perceive a guru if we ardently try to inculcate in ourselves the practices which was adopted by a guru in his process of evolution. That is where the concept of a chela comes in. Who is a chela? Gurus are not bodies. Gurus are evolved souls. We cannot really identify a guru in a person. But the assertion is made that we can identify a guru when we try to adopt the ideas which was adopted by the guru. Such a person is called as a chela, to put it in simple terms. Now we will consider what the theosophical glossary has to say about chela. Chela is a Sanskrit word which means a disciple, the pupil of a guru or sage, the follower of some adept of a school of philosophy. And literally, chela means a child. So we had earlier considered that since our birth, we come across a guru. The parents are considered as our first gurus. And then as we progress and grow up in our life, we come across many gurus. So the disciple of a guru is called as a chela, literally a child. Now, a guru, as we have established, is not a physical person or a physical body. Guru is an exalted soul. Guru is a pinnacle of evolution of humanity. And when one tries to emulate the ideas and practices inculcated by a guru, he is called as a chela. And such a person, people like us, we are literally childs. We are childs to those gurus. So what are some of the characteristics of a guru which one must try and emulate and adopt in their life? That very well Buddha, the guru, has in the same chapter which we considered in the devotional reading, page number 43 of Dhammapada, clearly he has laid down what are the characteristics of a guru. Enduring patience is one of the characters of a guru. A guru does not oppress another. A guru does not revile another. He does not harm another. A guru disciplines himself according to the law. A guru is the one who is moderate in eating. He dwells with solitude and is devoted to higher thought. Now, if we find certain characteristics like this in a person and we try to emulate them, then those ideas which we try to emulate, in our stage of evolution, those ideas themselves are the gurus. We know we need not try to perceive some soul which is evolved. We can directly try and emulate these basic ideas like maintaining patience, being moderate in eating, and being devoted to higher thought. You emulate those ideas. Those ideas are themselves the gurus. And then there are works like the Secret Doctrine, the Isis Unveiled, which are the messages recorded by such gurus. And those works are full of these ideas as to how a soul can evolve and reach perfection to become a guru. Now, if a student, a chela, a child, sits before those works and studies, that mere practice of studying these messages itself will aid the soul in its evolution towards attainment of perfection. Therefore, in that way, one may call those books themselves as gurus. So we don't need to go to all those places which we spoke about. No need to go to schools, universities, temples, churches, synagogues, mosques. Nowhere to be gone. No need to consult any self-appointed gurus, self-help gurus. No need to consult any astrologers to keep every step. To practice the basic principles which were adopted by these gurus. Those ideas are the gurus. The works recorded by the gurus are themselves the gurus. Try and study a book rather than keeping the book and keeping the book just for the sake of a purpose of ritual. Instead, open the book and study. And that itself will indicate that a person is putting his effort. That is the self-induced effort. That is the self-devised effort. Because there cannot be spoon-feeding on our path to evolution. No question of spoon-feeding. Self-induced and self-devised efforts. And when we are in the process of practicing the ideas given out in the books and the teachers, There may be many disturbances which come across, many memories which we will encounter, many painful feelings which we recall. But those are all the tests which come in, which basically gives one student a ground to apply the doctrines and the teachings which is recorded in the book. It gives you the material to work with so that we evolve. Now, without those tests, there is no question of evolution. Without the test, there cannot be evolution. But therefore, we must seize the opportunity which come to us because of our own prior actions, which is nothing but the action of the working of the law of karma. It will come. We must apply the ideas and overcome the tests with the flying colors so that each one of us ultimately becomes a guru. That is the key idea which is given out in the theosophical literature, where each and every one of us are in the path of becoming a guru. And as of now, we are students. And if we fail, there is no need to worry, because the nature as such it is, the scheme of the universe itself is for the perfection of the soul. That being the case, there is no question of failing. If we fail, you try again. There are infinite number of chances which the nature gives. There is no... It is not like the universe will dissolve if we don't try. But the key point here is to try and emulate the ideas recorded in the books and the ideas which have been adopted by the humans like us who have become gurus. That is the key point which the theosophical literature gives out. So, when that being the case, if one asks the question, who is a guru, whether a guru is an ideal, or is a guru a fact? Guru is an ideal as well as a fact. A guru is an idea, an ideal, which when a chela tries to emulate, it becomes a fact for that chela. So there is no question of asking whether they are existing or not, whether they are to be found in the Himalayas or not. No question of that. You adopt the ideas become facts. Therefore, when in one of the articles Mr. Judge has written, the topic of that article is called as the Mahatmas as Ideals and Facts. So who is a Mahatma? Who is a guru? One short paragraph captures all was said thus far in this short talk. I'll read that one small paragraph. Mr. Judge says, "The whole sweep, meaning, and possibility of evolution are contained in the word Mahatma. Maha is great, Atma is soul, and both compounded into one mean those great souls who have triumphed before us, not because they are made of different stuff and are of some strange family, but just because they are of human race. Reincarnation, karma, the sevenfold division, retribution, reward, struggle, failure, success, illumination, power, and a vast embracing love for man, all these lie in that single word, Mahatma. The soul emerges from the unknown, begins to work in and with matter, is reborn again and again, makes karma, develops the six vehicles for itself, meets retribution for sin and punishment for mistake, grows strong by suffering, succeeds in bursting through the gloom, is enlightened by the true illumination, grasps power, retains charity, expands with love for orphaned humanity, and thenceforth helps all others who remain in darkness until all may be raised up to the place with the Father in heaven, who is the higher self." Now, this would be the argument of the visitor from a distant planet, if he were to visit Earth and see and try to think and get the idea of who a master is, of who a guru is. So whatever was said earlier in the short talk is succinctly captured in this one paragraph, the epitome of evolution. There is one point which requires consideration about a guru, that he is full of charity. Now, one way it can be argued is that if a soul tries to evolve itself into becoming a guru, isn't that a selfish pursuit? If that is a selfish pursuit, then how can you say that it is charitable? That such a soul encapsulated in a body, how can you say that a guru is charitable? Because he is in the pursuit of attaining the pinnacle of evolution. That is one argument which comes across every time. Therefore, it is very important to recall again the words of Gautama Buddha, page 43, about the enlightened one. By what track can you allure one who is enlightened? Trackless indeed is he. His victory naught can undo. None of this world can touch that victory. He is a seer of limitless range. Trackless indeed is he. The stage of evolution in which we ourselves are, we would do well to emulate the ideas adopted by the gurus rather than getting into such literal arguments, because trackless indeed is the path. Try to adopt the ideals rather than coming up with intelligent arguments. Then teachings are very clear. If we can consider a portion of the Bhagavad Gita, it is very clear that if one abandons a self-interest in the actions performed, then that action is called as an excellent action. That is yoga. That one single verse of Bhagavad Gita is enough. By necessary implication, if an action a student or a chela performs is devoid of self-interest, by necessary implication, it means that it is charitable action. It is done for the whole world. If you are not doing it for yourself, it means that you have performed the action for the whole world. Therefore, abandon the fruits or the results of the action and perform the action with Krishna alone in the mind. That is the verse which is said in Bhagavad Gita. The inculcation of such practices in our everyday action, where you abandon the self-interest, by necessary implication means that a chela is performing such an action which is charitable. When such a charitable action is performed, there is no karma attached to such an action. When there is no karma attached to such an action, there is no retribution for such an action. You have already attained for a brief moment while performing that action, you have become the guru. Through constant practice of such actions, consciously, step by step, stage by stage, one can progress in the path to becoming a evolved soul, where the actions performed, since they are not for the self-interest, by implication it means it's a charitable action, it is performed for the whole world. And this is where the guru is called as a charitable, is an epitome of charity. So friends, with these few ideas about who is a guru and who is a chela, we will pause this short talk and take up any questions which one may have.
It is said in the theosophical literature that every person who is born, there is a guru. That's one point. And to every aspirant, there is a guru. From the time the aspirant meets the true guru, light to light and heart to heart, it may be ages, or it may be some incarnations, or it may be immediate, It all depends upon many factors, karmic factors. So for every soul, there is a guru. And we may also recall in this connection that every soul, as given in the third fundamental proposition, is an emanation of universal oversoul. In other words, every soul, eternal ego, is an emanation of one of the seven great hierarchies. So each soul, therefore, has a guru in that particular hierarchy.
So every soul born has a guru. That makes perfect sense, because we are not just the bodies. We are not just physical bodies. Physical body is just one sheath around the soul. There is the prana, there is the astral body, then there is the kamarupa, the desire body. And then there is a spark of manas. The manas is just lit up. The mind is lit up in us, in our stage of evolution. The manas, the man, is a thinker. Now, Mr. Judge, in this work, Ocean of Theosophy, speaks about the dual nature of manas. Now, the spark is lit up. But that spark is enmeshed in the kama rupa, the desires, and the other three bodies. When enmeshed in that body, the spark mistakes itself and identifies itself with those sheaths. The scheme of evolution, the purpose of whole manifestation, is that the spark realizes that it is not the desires. To realize that, the spark needs some ideas, some messages, a guru. A guru is not to be found somewhere externally. The ideas must be adopted by that spark. The ideas are already pre-existing in the higher part of the manas, which is shared, which is the basis of the brotherhood amongst all of us. So to say that it is shared amongst all of us, our higher nature is shared amongst all of us, and the higher nature is nothing but a reflection of the universal law, the law of karma, corollary to which is the law of reincarnation. The spark, the duty of the spark, is to clear up the channel, clear up the instruments, so that the ideas, the higher ideas, shine forth from the instruments, which may be desire body, including the physical body. Now, that is the real alchemy. That is the real conversion of this mass into gold. Now, literally, if one stabs a guru, he will not bleed blood, he will bleed gold. That should not be taken literally. It is when the spark, using the aid of the higher ideas, which is in the permanent memory of the higher mind, using that, the lower quaternary, which is the bodies, the other bodies, must be made porous so that that light shines forth. Therefore, it is said that every soul is born with a guru. It is not like one has to find a guru in the physical external world. The guru may not be even in the book. That the gurus are in the books, because the ideas of these the higher mind are recorded in that book. In that sense, the books can be considered as gurus, provided one puts the effort to study and inculcate the ideas into practice. But it necessarily does not mean a book, because book is also, end of the day, it is a physical thing, physical object. Therefore, when the student said that for every soul is born with a guru, it is in this sense it must be understood. So it makes a perfect sense. Yes, so the question which is put forth is that generally, the general understanding of a guru is such a person who observes, corrects, and gives method to overcome the mistakes. Yeah, general understanding is that a guru is a person, For example, a teacher in the school is called as a guru, who, if you are not performing up to the mark, he will observe and then correct. That is the general understanding. Yes. So therefore, is not to say that it is bad, but the theosophical literature is very clear that a student, a chela, learns by making mistakes and through his or her own personal effort and merit only the evolution is possible. Now, if we consider another person who is going to observe us and then correct us, basically it will be almost like a divestment of the responsibility of a chela. We cannot divest ourselves from the responsibility, because the key point here for the evolution of the soul is through self-induced and self-devised efforts, checked by karma. No other person can help, at least in the basic observance of patience, not getting angry. Now, you cannot ask a person to observe us 24 hours, our behavior. But when we go to the psychological level, no person knows what is going on in the mind of another student. So when that is the case, we cannot really expect an external person to really observe and correct us. But that is why the assertion made in theosophical doctrines is that the guru is your higher self. That guru is changeless. That guru, which is changeless, has the power and the ability to observe the changes going on before it. Therefore, that being more constant, that I within each and every one of us being constant, it can perceive the change. Once it can perceive the change through its power, which is called as will, can arrest those changes, at least for a moment, and put us in the right direction if we have the idea. But otherwise, it is not possible for any person to observe our thoughts. Thoughts, they change like the wind. They're faster than the wind. No person can catch the thoughts. Therefore, in the theosophical doctrines, which this student believes is more reasonable and more practical, that the more permanent of our own nature can arrest the modifications rather than an external person. An external person himself keeps changing. How can change perceive change and arrest change? More permanent entity can arrest the change. That is the basic, which also is a reasonable idea, just put forth in the theosophical literature and the doctrines. So, we cannot look for gurus externally. It's left to each student, each chela, to find a guru within himself. The question put forward is, can we say that our own consciousness is guru? Depends on the definition of consciousness, because there is, sleeping stage is there, the waking stage is there, the dream state is there, and then the deep sleep state is there. These are all four different stages of consciousness. So, conscience can be called as a guru in a way, but consciousness, different states of consciousness are there. Was posed to Mr. Judge. The question was that can the power to help of the Mahatmas be for any cause inhibited? The Mahatmas have the power to help. But can that power be inhibited? It can be inhibited. When the student asks, but why? Mr. Jat says that all effects on every plane are the result of forces set in motion and cannot be the result of nothing, but must ever flow from causes in which they are wrapped up. If the channel through which water is meant to flow is stopped up, the water will not run there. But if a clear channel is provided, the current will pass forward. Occult help from masters requires a channel just as much as any other help does. And the fact that the currents to be used are occult makes the need for a channel greater. The persons to be acted on must take part in making the channel or the line for the force to act. For if we will not have it, they cannot give it. So it can be inhibited. Therefore, masters cannot help. So therefore, the stress on the self-induced and self-devised efforts is laid down in the, it's a fundamental doctrine of theosophy. No responsibility can be shrugged off. It's for each student to put the personal effort and merit. So friends, with this, we have come to the end of this evening's short talk on the topic Crus and Chelas. Next week, same time, the topic under consideration will be the common basis of world religions. Thank you and have a good day.